electoral vote threshold to take the White House. Let's return now to our regularly scheduled program, which happens to be Community Matters and an analysis of the election. Here's Len Iaquinta.
This is Len Iaquinta for Community Matters. Our topic today is the election aftermath, what happened? My guests are Dean Peggy James, Ph.D. She is the Dean of the College of Social Sciences and Professional Studies and Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. One of her college's faculty also joins us, Professor Ross Astoria, J.D., Ph.D., Professor of Political Science and Law at UW-Parkside. And we have a special guest and my classmate at the Pulitzer Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University in the city of New York, beaming in from San Diego, California, is Barry Jagoda. Barry was the key TV and media advisor to Jimmy Carter's campaign, and he was President Carter's White House Special Assistant. His recently published book is a great read. It's called Journeys with Jimmy Carter and Other Adventures in Media. He currently is a consulting campaign media advisor, a media publicist for high technology companies, and a contributing writer for the Times of San Diego. And our fourth guest is a graduate of UW-Parkside, Wisconsin State Senator Bob Wirch, a Democrat representing District 22, which is basically eastern Kenosha and Racine counties. Good morning to each of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Len.
Morning.
Good morning, Len.
Well, let's begin with the presidential race. What is happening? By the way, listeners, we had to record this at 1 p.m. on the Thursday before broadcast, so don't hold us responsible for anything that's happened after then. At the time of this recording, the presidential race is still undecided. Both the Associated Press and the New York Times think that Biden is going to win, but they can't be sure. And I'm not sure that by the time this is broadcast late Saturday morning, that we'll have a president for sure anyway. Barry Jagoda, from your viewpoint as a former White House media advisor in the Jimmy Carter presidential candidacy and administration, what do you think is happening?
Well, of course, one big difference between President Carter and the incumbent president is President Carter said he would never lie to the American people. And we've noticed in this 2020 campaign that the incumbent, President Trump, seems not to be able to tell the truth. And it may be inability to tell the truth, is what might have gotten President Trump, there's a phrase called hung on his own petard, which is kind of like if you have a hook on your door and you hang a jacket there, it may get stuck. But if you happen to be a human being and you get hung on your own petard, you're stuck. So I think that may be the what we've seen here in 2020.
Senator Bob Wirch from the district that covers part of our listening area. Senator Wirch, what do you think is happening here?
Well, I think what I see is I'm interested in more competitive states, especially in the South. Of course, Florida has always been competitive, a close race, but to see Georgia become a competitive state, to see Arizona become a competitive state, and Texas, I think that shows you the demographics are changing in this country, and I think that's exciting, and it also shows that how split our country is. We have a history of close elections in Wisconsin. The president won by 25,000 last time, and it looks like he lost by 20,000 this time. Close in Michigan. It's a very split country with strong feelings on both sides. And I'm hopeful if we get a new president that we will come together, because this president has just made a career out of dividing the country and picking on different segments of the population.
Professor Astoria, I never thought that I would rely so much, by the way, on getting legal advice for a presidential election, but that's going to be a big deal. And so we're really happy that you're a Juris Doctor, as well as a professor of political science. Professor Astoria, what's happening?
Well, I was just I thought you might ask me that question. So I was just looking over the latest on the lawsuits, and literally 5 or 10 minutes before you started the recording, it looked like courts are starting to reject the lawsuits. And it looks like of those lawsuits that have been filed, most of them, even if they won, they would be pretty insignificant for the tally. And then a lot of them are, well, they're getting dismissed right now. And so I think the one big one that's got me a little interested and concerned is the one on Pennsylvania. And I guess by the time people read this, we'll know what happens here. But there's the procedural posture of it, which is kind of interesting, which is the Republican Party in Pennsylvania had challenged the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's interpretation of the law. That challenge went up to the Supreme Court of the United States, and it was a split 4-4, allowing that decision to stand. The procedural posture of that is, one of the suits that Trump has filed apparently is to be an intervener in that case. So rather than starting at the lower courts and then having to move up, he wants to be an intervener right at the Supreme Court, jumping right off of that previous Supreme Court case. So that would be interesting, perhaps worrisome outcome, maybe in terms of the tallying here. But I also think there's a very important part of allowing Supreme Courts to state Supreme Courts to interpret their own election laws. So an intervention there might be by the Supreme Court is something to keep your eyes on.
Well, there's a lot of conspiracy theories out there that the Supreme Court's opinions, the way they were written, suggests that they're just waiting to get this case so they can hand the victory to President Trump. Do you see that as a reasonable suspicion?
Well, the time lag between the recording and the hand will be in the viewing of this will tell us for sure. I think I disagree with the Supreme Court's interpretation there. I'm not sure there's a conspiracy quite so much. And I think this Supreme Court, as much as I worry about their kind of ideological orientation, I don't think they're going to intervene on Trump's behalf to undermine the institutional integrity of the court, which is pretty under a lot of stress right now anyway, unless they think there's a definitive way to shift the election to Trump. So if there's other states that are solidifying the lead for Biden, like Nevada and Arizona, I think the Supreme Court will abstain from an intervention.
Well, this is Barry Jagoda again. Dean James, you may recognize this comment. Even before the age of Trump, we were living in a very politically divided country. Political scientists were telling us that the partisanship, both among the electorate and among those elected, had never been as partisan as we found it in 2016 and in the decades before that. So as we think about the election and the divisions in the country, those were there before Trump. And then, so I had one other thought that I wanted to mention. Social science research was, particularly out of Stanford, was taking a look at the number of people who were infected after attending one of these Trump rallies. And the number was at least 700 infections, 700 deaths, rather, and 30,000 infections. And I found that to be shocking and disturbing, but not unexpected.
Dean James, what's your take?
Well, I think Barry's absolutely right that the division between the two parties is becoming increasingly polarized and has been since probably around the early 1990s, that there has been that. What I think this election actually shows us is that exactly that's what's happening, is that we have this real significant split between partisanship, and even some people have begun to identify it as rather than partisanship, but more like a tribal ideology where we're really, really resisting any sort of compromise or consensus or cooperation between people who aren't of the same mind as we are. So the election, I think, is not surprising. The election results are actually just reflecting what really was demonstrated in 2016 and appears to have gotten even more more embedded in our political system than it had been 4 years earlier. I think also, on one note too, is that people become more actively engaged in politics. So I don't want to lose sight of the fact that this election, the turnout, might be the second highest since 1900. And so in some ways, I would look at that optimistically. It might not be the way that we want to see it, but we're looking to actually be the second highest since 1900. And I think that's actually a really good thing to look at. Unfortunately, a lot of that participation is acrimonious and is not necessarily what we'd like to see, but at least it's engagement. And I don't want to lose sight of that either.
They're saying that Joe Biden has accumulated more votes for president than have ever been cast for a person for president. I don't know if that has any significance or not, really. I mean, does that really, if suppose he's president, so what? What if any significance do you attach to that, any of you?
Well, this is Senator Wirch. I've always said that I'm an optimist, and Donald Trump is the best organizer the Democratic Party could have ever hoped for. The Democratic Party is, has been described as trying to herd turkeys to do something and going in different directions, and he has united us, and Jill Stein, I think, hurt us drawing away votes last time, but Trump's been a unifying force for us, and I think that's a good thing for our party.
Well, it looks like President Trump has unified Kenosha, Racine, and Walworth counties even more for the Republican column. I've shared with you all on the call some very interesting statistics, the principal counties in our listening area. In Kenosha, Trump won by 238 votes in Kenosha County last time. This time, he in Kenosha County, he won by 2,300 votes. In Racine, 2016, he won by 2,100, this time by 4,300. In Walworth County, he won by 10,000, this time by 11,000. What's going on, Senator Wirch? Why is southeastern Wisconsin becoming more Republican or more Trump-oriented? How do you account for that?
Well, first of all, let me argue with you a little bit. I think that those are the vote totals. But I have three Democratic representatives in Racine and Kenosha, and they were all had Republican opponents, and they all won with a landslide. Now, I describe a landslide as anything over 55%, and they were all comfortably over that. So that points out the difference between urban and rural in those areas. And let's face it, any president has a powerful influence. And Donald Trump was in Kenosha twice, and he did a good job of ginning up his base to come out and vote. And I give him credit for that. I don't agree with I disagree with him on 90% of his ideas, but he knows how to work the levers of popularity out there, and he has Fox News. So we never underestimate our opponent, and he got his base out, but we had big victories in the urban areas in the legislature.
Well, Senator, this is Barry again. Let me ask you, to what extent do you think that the some would call violence in the streets, other would call peaceful protests, other would call Antifa, to what extent do you think that influenced the Southeast Wisconsin vote?
Oh, I'm glad you brought that up. I forgot to mention it. Yes, I think it definitely had a an effect on the turnout, and I certainly had a number of constituents call me up that were scared to death and worrying if their neighborhood would be invaded. And so, yes, that was a factor. Certainly law and order. We had not had that type of violence in Kenosha. I talked to someone in Madison. They said, we have that all the time, busting the windows on State Street and stuff like that. So it was new to Kenosha and did have a definite effect on the vote.
Well, Barry, again, one thing that historically we've seen is the impact of what can happen in the presidential debates. For example, many decades ago, when the very civilized and gentle incumbent president, Gerald Ford, agreed to debate Jimmy Carter, there hadn't been presidential debates at that point since the Kennedy, the famous Kennedy-Nixon debates. And in that those debates, I was, in addition to the first debate, of course, Trump was Trump and making a fool of himself. But in the second debate, I was very concerned about Biden stepping away from fracking and from petroleum, particularly with an eye on how that might influence Pennsylvania. You know, a small gaffe can go a long way in these presidential debates, and we've seen that historically. And I think Biden hurt himself very badly by announcing that he was going to go to a transition from petroleum sources. I think that hurt him very much in Pennsylvania. And then one more thing on the, quote, law and order issue. You know, there was the shooting in Philadelphia last the week before the election. And that when there's that kind of activity in the street, it helps a demagogue who talks about law and order. And I think Trump has demagogued that to a great extent.
Hold that thought for our listeners. We're talking on Community Matters this morning about the election aftermath, and my guests are Dean Peggy James, Professor of Political Science and Dean at UW Parkside, Professor Ross Astoria, J.D., Ph.D., Political Science at Parkside, former Carter advisor Barry Jagoda, and our State Senator Bob Wirch from this district. Let's talk a little bit more about the debates and the civil unrest, which I think the civil unrest certainly has had a big impact here in southeast Wisconsin and perhaps in the whole state. Who would like to pick that up? Ross?
I'm going to have to. I didn't actually watch the debates. I had other things going on. We have another member of the department who does that sorts of thing. The on the law and order side, I would be really interested to know if those upticks in participation on the Republican voting in Kenosha were seen was caused by a kind of law and order a rhetoric there. One thing, and Ken, thanks, or Len, thanks for putting those together. I would like to see the numbers out of the Milwaukee and the Madison area as well, because we got an uptick in voting for Republicans in these three counties here, but those must have been overwhelmed by an uptick in voting out of the Milwaukee area and the Madison area. So it'd be interesting to see how the various types of violence and worry and concern impacted people coming out. I can see more Milwaukee voters coming out for Biden because of what was happening in Kenosha, but also more Trump voters coming out in Kenosha because of what was going on.
Peggy, Dean James?
Yeah, I think in terms of the law and order issue, if you look at some of the national exit polls, law and order was actually one of the top five issues that got people out to vote, but it was not really up there. In other words, it wasn't the first or the second. The first was the economy, and then also some sort of issue about social justice, but not law and order, and then coronavirus, and then the actual law and order issue. So it seems that nationally, anyway, that it was not the greatest motivator to get people out there to make a decision and actually vote. I would say, however, that what it did do was that it probably served to exacerbate the rural-urban divide. because you've already, senators, Wirch has already mentioned the real difference between Kenosha County and then the city of Kenosha, and the same thing happened in Racine and the city of Racine. I think that the urban-rural divide, and by the way, I'd recommend a great book by Kathy Kramer on the urban-rural divide in Wisconsin, has been there for a long time. And what this simply did was it exacerbated that division and made people think of Kenosha, the city of Kenosha, as much more dangerous when they weren't in the city of Kenosha. In other words, they were, as they say here, west of the eye, right?
Well, let's talk about polls for a minute. You brought up exit polls. What about the pre-election polls? A lot of people are calling for the polling experts to be rending their garments and dunking their heads in the tank because they didn't accurately predict the election. Now, I studied enough survey research back in grad school 100,000 years ago to know that polling is fraught with limitations. It's just fraught with limitations, more limitations than most people have any reason to guess. What's your take, Professor James, on the polling? And I'm going to ask each of you, on that. But let's start with you, Peggy.
Well, we had Charles Franklin do a great presentation for us here at Parkside just a couple of weeks ago, and he is the director of the Marquette University Law School polls, as you probably know. He spoke about 2016 and sort of explained some of the issues that they thought that they had solved so that they would not make that same mistake again. And I'm probably going to get an email from Charles on this after Saturday. But a couple of the issues that they had supposedly solved was that they had, not in terms of the sampling, but that they had overweighted certain populations. And one of those populations, interestingly enough, was the college student population. So they'd given college students more weight than they probably should have, given their participation rates and the history of their involvement. And so they sort of worked out that, and he was feeling a bit more confident. There is also the issue that he brought up that I actually really, really think is a big factor, and that is what people have called the shy Trump voter, is that people who are going to vote for Trump won't tell you because they don't want to get involved. They really, and I think this actually comes from a lot of very quiet, passively resistant conservatives out there who are just afraid to actually say that they're going to vote for Trump. I think that happened in 2016, and actually I think it happened in 2020.
Well, I think you're right, Dean. You know, the only pollster in 2016 that predicted a Trump victory said that Trump was going to win regardless of the polls because of the enthusiasm for him that was not detected in the polls. And I think that one of the shocking things about the 2020 election was how the anti-Trump partisans were dancing a jig for weeks and weeks before the election, just assuming that Biden would roll to a victory. And something happened, and we still don't know why all of the polls called for a Biden victory, and all of the polls called that the incumbent, Trump, would go down in defeat. And is there a bias there, Dean?
Is there a bias in the media, or is there a bias in the polls?
In the polls.
Well, in terms of the polls, I think there's a lot of actually process-related things that will cause issues. A lot of our polls are still based on call-in, and so they actually mm-hmm. have conversations with folks. And, you know, certain people answer their phones and certain people don't. And there's demographics that are associated with that. And again, certain people will not respond honestly when they're actually talking to a person. Some of the polls now are beginning to use online answers, and they're finding that those are a little bit less intimidating for folks and are more likely to get more accurate responses.
Senator Wirch, I wonder if you would comment on your take on the polls, and maybe you have some information about polling in southeastern Wisconsin for some of our local races.
Well, I've given up on the polls, quite frankly. I heard Charles Franklin say the week before the election that Hillary was 5 to 6 points ahead. And then he said the same thing this year for Biden. And what? It was basically a draw. I think they won by 20,000 votes. I think, and everybody polls. You know, it's kind of like people, if you turn on the business channel, they're always trying to forecast what the stock market's going to do. And there's an old saying, if you can't project accurately, project often, so they forget. And I just think that the Democrats would be better off, instead of polling, to use that money on campaigns. I think it's wasted money.
Now, of course, we still, at the time of recording this, in the very early part of the afternoon on Thursday before broadcast, we still don't know who's going to be president, but I have a higher level question to ask you. So what? So what who is elected? Because what's the situation in the House of Representatives? What's the situation in the Senate? Is Congress in such a situation of that we're going to have deadlock no matter what? What's your outlook, Professor Astoria? What, want to take the first crack at that?
Yeah, happily. So I end up watching the executive agencies quite closely, like the Environmental Protection Agency, mm-hmm. and such as that, and they are making important regulatory decisions, and so orienting those agencies in the right direction, I think, is important. I'm especially concerned about environmental law. So there's a couple of things that the EPA has done, which I don't think are legal. So they've tried to revoke California's greenhouse gas waiver on mobile sources. The Trump DOJ has actually sued California for engaging in the linking of their cap and trade system with Quebec. I think under a Biden administration, that we can start to rebuild the integrity of some of these institutions, which is what was concerning me most about a second Trump administration, is the continued integrity of those. And then I've been doing some international work around climate, and it's going to be a really tough slog to get America back at the table on the international side and build that confidence up. So, you know, getting a different executive in there can help in those areas. One of the big decisions that we got a flag here that it's we've not got COVID at all under wraps, and it's really bad here in Wisconsin right now. For those of you watching, my wife is just recovering and I'm in quarantine right now, almost out. It's a scary thing, and we can't get the economy going until we've gotten that battened down, so we can get some helpful rhetoric out of a new president here, maybe on COVID containment. But I do think we need more bills. So
I'd like to associate myself with everything you said, Ross. And on election night, I went to sleep really worried, thinking that Trump would be reelected, and all of these terrible things that he had done, particularly in administrative law, on the matters you raise, we were going to have to live through another 4 years. And so that's why there was such relief from this person. I tried to be an independent voter, but it's clear that Trump devastated so much of government. You know, government's there to be used. And that was the real problem, I thought, with the 4 years of the Trump administration, is that he was there to destroy government instead of using it in a positive way. And one other thing, I asked a couple of people how they voted, and several people said, oh, they voted for Trump, and which was kind of surprising, because I couldn't find that many people who had voted for Trump in my coterie. And I said, why? Well, I don't want to live in a socialist country, they said. So that demagogic those charges of communism and socialism and such, I think, took hold among a certain percentage of the electorate.
Yes, red baiting does seem to be back, doesn't it? Dean James, no one's talking about any new legislation to help with COVID-19 to stimulate the economy so far on this discussion. Do you agree that progressive legislation in particular, and maybe any legislation, is going to be stymied? Is all the action going to be in the executive office, no matter who wins the presidency?
I haven't seen any real indications that the makeup of the Congress is going to be any different than it was in the last 4 years. So it appears that the Senate will be controlled by the Republicans and then the House by the Democrats. And so I actually don't foresee a lot of progressive legislation getting through. I think there'll be more cooperation on perhaps foreign affairs, and certainly with the executive having more power in terms of agency regulation and things like that, we can see some movement there. But anything that actually requires cooperation in the Congress, I think, will be just as bogged down as it has been in the past.
Of course, it doesn't take much cooperation from the Congress for the president to wear a mask. And when the president says wear a mask, that has a big impact, as opposed to a president just being cavalier about all this. We know that we have to do something about the virus before we can work on the economy. That's a simple fact. And presumably, a president will move us in the direction of intelligent scientific basis for dealing with the virus. And only then can we do something about the economy. And that's something we really have to look forward to, assuming that we are dealing with President Biden for the years beginning in 2020.
Now, Barry, you have White House and Washington experience. Do you think that the lame duck session of Congress, before they finally adjourn these sessions, is Congress going to do anything to help the American economy and to help us recover from COVID-19? Do you see any potential for movement in the next month or so?
Well, there has to be leadership. And so far, what we know is that on the Senate side, the Senate is going to be Republican. It's going to be under the thumb of Moscow Mitch McConnell. And so there's not going to be any progress there. But that does not mean that with good leadership in the White House, we can't begin to make progress on using science to work on the virus. And once we make some progress there, then we can begin to think about the economy.
State Senator Wirch, you and I have been around the block a long time here in southeastern Wisconsin. You've seen a lot. Let's turn a little bit more to southeastern Wisconsin now. I wonder if, Senator Wirch, you would start by talking about how the election shook out in Racine, Kenosha, and Walworth in terms of the state assembly and the state senate, and what you see in the future there. You did mention a little bit about some of the success in the races. And aren't we in the same situation here in Wisconsin in terms of deadlock? We have a Democratic governor. The Republicans seem to have firm control of the legislative branches. Bob, what's your point of view?
Well, first of all, let me make a comment on the national picture. I'm optimistic. I think the shame of the Republican Party is that all the elected officials were scared to death of Donald Trump. Their worst nightmare was to have him tweet something against them, and he literally had them under his thumb. If Donald Trump isn't there anymore, I think there's a real chance that there could be more bipartisanship. I'm hopeful for that. And of course, on a national picture, I've never been as ashamed of this country as when they separated families at the border, took children from their parents. That won't happen. We can get an attorney general who believes in the rule of law instead of the rule of Trump. And I think all those things are positive moves. Now, getting back to the state picture.
But that's a big if. That's a big if. We still don't know at the time we're recording this on Thursday.
Well,
whether
I'm saying if Biden is in there. But, that's what the Nazis did. They separated families. And that was just shameful for our country to do that. And, I know Obama deported a lot of people, but he didn't have the mean streak that this president does. So I'm hopeful there's we can work out something on immigration. It's been a difficult situation for legislation for many years. On the state level, I'm thankful for Tony Evers. I've been around a long time. I've seen, what makes me laugh is they say the Democratic Party has changed. Well, I was around under Tommy Thompson when compromise was the way things worked out in the Capitol. Now it's a dirty word. And so I'm hopeful if there's a change on the national level with more bipartisanship that it'll filter down to the state level. But right now we have very few moderate Republicans in this building.
Well, taking a deep dive into history, Wisconsin is such fertile territory because, of course, it is your state that produced Senator Joseph McCarthy.
Yes.
And also, one has the sense that the University of Wisconsin, particularly the Madison campus, was the opposite of that. So, you know, nothing is certain, but Wisconsin is a battleground of ideas.
Bob, what's going to get done in Madison? What's going to get done in Madison for the rest of this year and next year? Is what are the chances for legislation that will help the people of Wisconsin and not some of these pet causes that some of the legislators bring up but don't really have an impact on the huge number of people living in poverty and near poverty here in southeastern Wisconsin? You and I know that depending on where you are, between 25% and 35% of the population in some of the center cities, it's far higher than that, are in poverty or near poverty. What hopes do you have for the legislative action in Wisconsin in the coming year?
And let me say, the situation is getting worse in the service industry with bars and restaurants being shut down and people who work there. We need a stimulus bill coming out of Washington to help state and local government because the revenue isn't coming in, and clearly our burden is heavier helping people through human services. And so we need a federal stimulus. You know, these right-wingers are mean-spirited. I mean, our minimum wage in Wisconsin is $7.25 an hour. It hasn't changed. 26 states have a higher minimum wage. Even Florida, that went Republican, passed a referendum to raise the minimum wage in increments to $15 an hour. Expanding Medicaid was turned down in Wisconsin by the legislative Republican leaders. Red states like Oklahoma and Missouri in referendum said they wanted to expand Medicaid. So we're not the progressive state we used to be, and we're kind of regressive in a lot of our policies. And so I see no real hope for major change to help with poverty in our state. And the election kind of backed up the people in power, so I'm not optimistic.
I'd like just to do a quick, very quick lightning round on how do you think this election, no matter who wins, how do you think this election is going to play on the international stage in terms of the reputation and the standing of the U.S. of A.? Barry.
Well, first of all, the United States will get back into the accord with Iran and temper that down. Secondly, if you'll permit this, Lynn, regardless of who ends up winning, just the idea that the president would threaten to fire the leading infectious disease expert, Dr. Fauci, sums up the whole Trump administration as far as I'm concerned, regardless of how that turns out.
Okay, Peggy, Dean James, how does this play out on the international stage?
I think internationally, we've probably lost a good deal of faith from our international community in our election process itself. We've seen some things that have happened here that have never happened before. I've done a lot of work in developing nations, and never have I ever seen any fires or explosives put in ballot boxes in the United States, even though I've seen it throughout Central and South America. And I think that just the way that we've handled this particular election will not play well for us internationally.
Ross, quickly, your take.
Yes, ditto with on what Peggy said. And then I think we just got a lot of work internationally to rebuild trust.
Now, as we close, finally, I want to ask each of you from your personal perspective, What is your number one takeaway from this week, that is through Thursday noon when we're recording this? I'm going to start with you, State Senator Bob Wirch. What's your number one takeaway?
The people are energized. They came out to vote, and I hope that they stay engaged because the big problem in this country is people don't know their recent American history, and they don't know their civics, and therefore they've been led by a demagogue.
Professor Ross Astoria, your number one takeaway.
Number one takeaway. I don't know I have a takeaway quite yet. One takeaway is I don't trust the polls, but I was thinking this would be razor thin anyway, and I think it's going to be really interesting if it's razor thin in each state, but Biden ends up with a lot of electoral votes. That would be quite a takeaway to think about.
Dean Peggy James.
I think the election just illustrates the extreme polarization that has been taking place in our society. And this is something that I think we all need to look at, even within our own parties, is that we've allowed ourselves to perhaps be more extreme about judgments of the other. And that's actually reduced our ability to arrive at some sort of cooperative solution to any of our public problems.
And how would you receive that as being resolved?
The election, I don't think anybody had any hope that the election would resolve it. And so that's not it. What I would suggest is that there, a lot of these things need to be handled locally by more engagement, as Senator Wirch said, more self-reflection on the part of not only how do Reds talk to Blues, but how do Reds talk to themselves? How do Blues talk to themselves? And to do that on a much more local level, I don't think this can be handled on the state level. The national level.
Very well. And I'm going to turn now to my presidential media guru and dear friend, Barry Jagoda. Barry, what's your takeaway?
I think we have seen in this election, regardless, the power of the presidency. The power of the presidency for evil and potentially for good. And so I came away hoping that the result of the 2020 election would be to turn out Trump and bring in a civilized person into the White House where a great deal of difference can be made.
Now, if you were to look ahead, Barry, into the future, what do you think would be the legislative agenda that President Trump or President Biden could get through Congress in the next year?
Well, I think Ross Astoria put his finger on administrative matters, pointing people to regulatory positions. And if it's Biden, that'll make a huge difference. If it's Trump, we'll have more of the same indecency. And he said he was going to drain the swamp, but we know that was just a campaign rhetoric. And it's not a swamp. It's the government. We need to make government work for the people. And the president is where that starts.
Is there a future for presidential debates, since you're a debate master?
Well, there must be presidential debates. Of course, if you're behind in the polls, you want to debate. And if you think you need to get a leg up for some other reason, you debate. So even President Ford in 1976, we'll be seeing debates in forever, ad infinitum, and I think that's the case. I don't see how anybody running for president, even a Trump who tried to back out, can avoid presidential debates, and I think they're extremely valuable.
If you were advising Trump, would you have advised him to go ahead with that other debate?
I think Trump had no choice because he was being depicted as being far behind. Trump wanted every opportunity to demagogue the American people. And so it was not merely a debate, an exchange of ideas. In Trump's case, he just wanted to push his agenda further. I think Biden had a more balanced perspective. But, you know, you have to be careful about one's bias and check your bias at the door. I think Trump had a debate, and I think Biden was glad that he debated. And I think Trump, every time Trump goes before the American people, even these phony rallies, he hurts himself.
Thank you. Thank you to State Senator Bob Wirch, Professor Ross Astoria, Dean Peggy James, both from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, and to presidential media expert Barry Jagoda. For Community Matters, this is Len Iaquinta, urging you to get informed and get involved. Good day.
It's 11:59. We're a minute away from news from NPR. The preceding Community Matters program, as you may have surmised, was recorded prior to the Associated Press calling the presidential